Okay, you were mentioning that.
Well, we had to go before the Planning Commission, and Frank can fill out the details about conditional use permits and all of the legal entanglements. These houses had all been grandfathered into their purposes out in the community of Lexington. What the city fathers discovered when we were proposing to do $10 million worth of renovations, which turned out to be closer to 13, that they might have an opportunity to undo all of these conditional use permits and to insist upon a new order of behavior. They were going to become deans of students for us, the city council, and would withdraw the permit, you see. They were grandfathered and permanent, the way they were now in these derelict houses. But we were going to invest on average $750,000 in each of these houses to bring them up to standard, put house mothers in them, create house corporations that actually function, and have a more active interfraternity council and all that. We were going to do all that. But they were going to say, well, if we find 5 months downstream that there's been a noise violation in house A, then we will withdraw the permit for group non-familial individuals living together, you know, I've forgotten how that reads, but that's what the... Then we will withdraw that and they can no longer be an effective fraternity house. And you said, I said, are you telling me that you're asking me or endorsing my investment of $13 million of the university's money? And maybe I've got 17 non-useful houses for 6 months from now because somebody called in a noise violation at Pike A at 12 o'clock? You're mad. Anyway, I stood before the Planning Commission at one point. It was all this noise about whether or not they were going to endorse this. I finally got up and said, ladies and gentlemen, it's become very clear to me that you prefer what we now have to what we might achieve, and I'm going to go away from this meeting and withdraw this petition before you so that you will no longer have to worry about it. You can have what you have, and we'll make do some way with the... I also said I find it absolutely astonishing that a responsible body of city government would turn down an opportunity to see $13 million worth of renovations take place in the most squalid corners of the city. But that's your affair. I was that angry at what's going on, so... Because they couldn't touch the grandfather. I could have left them to go to hell in a handbasket, and they could never have touched them, except as the police touch them every time they do misbehave. So anyway, that was a bit of a struggle, and Frank beside himself with my lack of patience, I think, at that point, because he had pretty good working relationships with the city, and I had sort of undone those in about 10 minutes, but I was... beside myself that we'd gone to all that we'd gone through. Good. And so anyway, we got by that. They quickly changed their minds about it. And
so what happened? What was their response when you did that?
Well, they decided that it would be possible to not change the grandfathered character of these permits and to let us go forward with the renovations. We were observing all the building codes.
Okay, let's take a pause.
Yeah. Okay.
During our break, we've been talking about how the student body has really changed. And one of the things, of course, I'm very prejudiced where I'm coming from, but I've always made the assumption that the introduction of women has made a big difference in the university. And you were very much a part of that process. Can we talk about that, about how that came to be?
Oh, yes. That's
and the drama of it, I'm sure it was dramatic.
Well, it was near the end, and there were a few moments out on the alumni circuit when it was dramatic, I suppose, or at least trying.
What do you mean the alumni circuit? Tell me what that means.
Well, this whole process involves several stages of consideration, obviously, and action. But I think I told you earlier on that when I started to come to Washington and Lee in the fall of 82, I came weekly to talk with faculty, chiefly faculty, one-on-one, no major meetings, but just individual conversations, the burden of which was to say, okay, Mame, I want to come to know you and your work and what interests you have intellectually and what courses you teach and then your general perceptions of the state of the university and what we might do to enhance your work or remove impediments to make it better, your work with students. And I will never forget, it was Harlan Beckley, but I hadn't singled out Harlan over anybody else at that point, but Harlan was one who echoed a theme that was widely sounded in those conversations when he pushed a book across the table toward me and said, this is Schleiermacher, whom I'm accustomed to teaching in the advanced courses in the religion department, and I fear that the bottom third of my classes are no longer capable of understanding Schleiermacher. And when that happens, my interest in remaining at Washington Lee will be very seriously damaged. So it became known as the soggy bottom third. We still had bright young people around, many attractive, and I'm proud of them, and you know, it's a when you talk about declining standards, people tend to think you're talking about the whole group. Well, you are in a way, because the average board scores drop very, very significantly over those years, in 10 to 15 years. But there were still bright, bright, able kids in every class, and then there were what the faculty perceived was a growing number of kids who were not intellectually acute, who were not terribly interested, enjoyed W&L and wanted the degree as this kind of a passport. So it became quickly clear to me that improving the student quality of the student body was the number one, and no one felt that more strongly than the Dean of Admissions, Bill Hartog, who himself had only come 3 or 4 years before and had some sense of the whole, obviously. So anyway, that was all part of a process that continued into the spring of 83, winter and spring of 83, when I was in residence and I was much more intensely involved, able to perceive things myself, rather than strictly through the eyes of the faculty. And by the spring of 83, I was emboldened enough to address the alumni at their annual reunion time in May in the chapel. And this was a speech that was largely reproduced in the alumni magazine in subsequent months. And it in effect said that coeducation was something that this institution had to take a serious look at and re-examine, because, and then I cited a number of reasons, all mainly to do with academic achievement. Almost no one noticed. No one in the chapel said, wait a minute, or, you know, or buzzed outside. I don't even recall that the alumni magazine had a big impact on people, which might mean that they don't read it, I don't know. But by that fall, which was only 9 months after I arrived, but really 14 months after I started thinking seriously about Washington Lee, I went to the board and said, you must study this question. I don't want the faculty to do it. I don't want the administration to do it. I would like the trustees to lead this study. Because there had been a study in 69, mainly a faculty study, quite thorough, and it came out with a recommendation to change. which the board didn't accept. And then in 74 or 5, midway through the campaign that Bob Huntley was so ably running, there was another pass at it, but it wasn't more than that. It didn't even disturb the surface of the lake. And then 83 was the next. And the trustees guardedly agreed to do this, using the standing committee structure of the board as the instrumentality. So we, of course, helped with studies and data and white papers and so on. That went on then through 83, 84. And then it was very widely known in the alumni body because we, against my judgment, but very strongly supported by Ferris, and I suppose by Brian, I think Brian was there by then, that we should have an alumni survey of attitudes toward co-education. And I said, it'll be misunderstood if you send this to 16,000 alumni. They'll think they're voting. And we'll have a referendum, and it won't come out very well, and so on. Well, no, we're going to have a scientific sort of slant on this, and we'll get an outside firm, which, you know, you hire an outside firm for large sums of money to come in, and then they have to ask you what questions they should ask. It struck me. But anyway, we did it in the spirit of trying to say this is an open process. Nobody's trying to hide anything from anybody else. And so in that sense, it probably was ultimately sensible to do. And one of the questions was, if Wash and Lee was to face a significant decline in its academic reputation, would you then support, if it had the promise of correcting that, co-education? And 70% or something said yes. If the academic standards were at stake, all the rest of it was very clearly opposed to co-education in the undergraduate. We had the law school experience of 7 or 8 or 10 years, whatever it was. At any rate, student body were opposed, and that was interesting because I was having dinners with seniors all through that spring, 25 at a time, and I would go around the table with them and say, okay, you tell me what's good about Wash and Lee and what's bad about Wash and Lee, and you tell me also, what are your attitudes about women at Washington? And I would have almost no one stand and say, well, I really think women should be admitted here. It would make life a lot more pleasant for everybody, et cetera, et cetera. It would probably improve the student body. One kid, I remember to my astonishment, actually said, I didn't know it was an all-male place till I arrived. He said, I went to the chapel with the freshman class meeting, and I looked around, and to my astonishment, there wasn't a single woman in the class, and I couldn't believe my... He said the catalog was full of pictures of women, and I'd never visited. Never occurred to me that it was an all-male place. Anyway, but the next day, after one of these dinners, I would have one or two come by and say, you know, I didn't speak up last night, but I wanted you to know that I think, and a lot of my friends think also, that this isn't quite as open and shut a case as some of the people you heard last night. I couldn't see. What I learned was the students were imprisoned in loyalty. If they stood up and said, a fundamental change of this sort should take place, they were in effect saying, there's something wrong here, and it needs fixing, and this would be a way to try to fix it. And they didn't want to say that, especially in front of each other. But they came, they made it clear to me, a little note sometimes. At one stage, I asked the faculty to write to me in a personal way their attitude about this prospect. And I had over 100 replies. I think the faculty, if you took the physical education coaches and so on out, and the librarians who have faculty rank, if you put them to one side, the faculty with the law school might have numbered 120 or 30. So we had almost all of the faculty. I separated the responses from faculty who are also alumni And there were many, 20 or 25 alumni who had gone off and taken their PhDs and come back. People like Sidney Colley and Jay Cook and Steve Stevenson and a number of other people like that. So that the board would have this notebook of letters which separated the regular faculty from the regular faculty who were not undergraduates at Washington from these others. And I said, these others I want you to pay special attention to because they knew the institution you knew. Now they're watched it over these years and the faculty. And that was a terribly helpful.
So what response did you get from the faculty?
Oh, it was 90%+ saying this should happen. This is very important that it should happen. I couldn't have won this. Well, I couldn't have survived, I'll put it that way, the co-ed debate if I hadn't had the faculty. I mean, I didn't have the alumni. I didn't nominally didn't have the students. I really needed some support somewhere, and the faculty were clearly an important part of that. I took the staff up on the mountain to Skylark, too, by the way, the administrative staff. We had a retreat up there in the summer of 83, when I said, am I stepping into a great chasm here, even by asking for the study to go forward? And everyone up there, which included graduates of Washington Lee, like Lou John and Ferris Hotchkiss, and I'm trying to think who they all were. I think Bill McHenry might have been then athletic director up there. But there were 10 or 12 people I was meeting with, and only Bill Washburn said no. And he was accurately reflecting his alumni constituency, because he was the director of alumni programs then, or whatever we called it. And Bill McHenry was wishy-washy. I wouldn't put it that way in any article. But I think he'd rather things remain the way they were, but that if we decided, then of course, in earnest, they would go forward with women's programs, which they clearly did. Anyway, so I had a lot of support at home. Now, going out on the road was very different. When we went out and speak to alumni clubs, this is the first time they'd seen me, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And here I am talking about co-education and the study going forward. And at the Congressional Country Club up in Washington, I remember a terrible evening. And alumni were actually quarreling with each other out in the audience. I was speaking, you know, and maybe somebody raised his hand and I recognized him and he nominally addressed me, but he was answered by somebody else out there, and holy tamale, it was really not very pleasant, you know, because their feelings were so sharp. Ferris and I touched down in Shreveport, Louisiana for a meeting there, and Ferris leaned over and just, we were ready to come to the gate, and he said, you know, John, this may be the toughest alumni meeting you will ever address. They're very conservative people here, and they're not at all sympathetic with the introduction of women. I said, why are you telling me this? I can't avoid the meeting. It's too late. So I went down to the whatever country club to meet with the Shreveport alumni. Dr. Wilson, so pleased to have you in Shreveport. We do look forward to coming to know you better. Next person, Dr. Wilson, how can we welcome you more warmly than we do? Then they go to Ferris. What in the hell is he up to? But then I sat down at the head table, and I sat next to a charming lady whose husband was presiding. He was president of the local club. Frierson is his last name. She's Ivy. I'm trying to think of, I can't think of, this guy's first name, but anyway, I know him very well, and I know Ivy very well. She's mother of 4 or 5. Deep, rich Southern accent. So I said, Ivy, where did you go to college at one point in conversation? "Oh, Dr. Wilson," she said, "I went to Suwannee." I said, "You went to Suwannee? Well, you must have been one of the early co-ed classes at Suwannee." "I was in the very first co-ed class at Suwannee." I said, "You were?" I said, "Well, tell me, how did you make that decision?" "Oh, Dr. Wilson," she said, "my brothers went to Suwannee, my daddy went to Suwannee, and my granddaddy helped found Suwannee. I found it a great privilege. They opened the doors to, finally, to permit women in the family to enjoy that same tradition." I thought, this is an easy situation. Part of what made this all come about as reasonably as it did was that people discovered that they had daughters, you know, and they hadn't thought of it that way before. And one of the trustees, when we sat there on the Bastille Day and were about to vote, Jim Ballinger said, "I'm going to go all the way around the table one more time, and everyone is going to speak his mind and his heart on this subject. And then we will go back around and actually cast a vote." So he started down. One gentleman said, "You know, I didn't sleep a wink all last night. I paced the floor." "Yes, I was below you. I heard you." And said, another one stood up and said, "You know, the worst day in my life was the day I suddenly realized that by policy, my daughters were not going to be permitted to share in what I had so much enjoyed myself. But my sons declined to do so because they did not wish to go to a single-sex college." And this theme started to sound out there. I said two things before the vote. I said to the board, "I am 51 years old. I am able. I'm not worried about my future. I will try to work your will, whichever it is, but I'm perfectly well aware that it may not be possible for me to be very effective if this vote should be turned down. But I don't want you to worry about that. Take me out of this vote. No votes I, because you don't want to isolate me or appear to repudiate me. That would be the worst possible thing. Vote the issue. Don't vote me. I can survive, whether here or whether somewhere else. Secondly, let's agree," and I hadn't thought this through, nor had I politicked this. You can ask any trustee then sitting if I ever called and said, "How do you feel about this, and will you vote on Saturday next, etc.?" I had no idea in many, many of these cases. I knew who was opposed from correspondence, from earlier conversations and board meetings and so on. But anyway, but the positives kept their, a lot of them kept their views to themselves until they finally had to make, you know, the decision. Second thing I said is, let's not decide a matter of this moment to the whole community at Washington Lee by a single majority. I said, I don't think that would be fair. One who was opposed said, "What do you have in mind, John, two-thirds? And I thought, uh-oh, he's counted. I haven't, he has. But I said, "Well, I don't know, that sounds reasonable to me." And then another trustee said, "But we have a bylaw that says that whenever we have a quorum, a simple majority prevails and does the work of the board. And how are you going to get around that?" And Jim Ballinger said, "Well, I think those of us who vote aye, who vote yes, find ourselves with a simple majority, will agree beforehand to change our votes in a subsequent vote to move it, and so we can avoid the problem." Well, then there was one more point worth mentioning, and that is that there were two trustees who weren't able to be there. One because of illness, Alzheimer's disease, and one because he was in Ireland, where he has a summer home, Hal Clark from Atlanta. And Hal wanted to vote from Ireland by telephone. And Al from Lexington, North Carolina. Al, it'll come. his wife wanted him to vote. She represented him as keenly interested in this and would be feel awful if he couldn't participate. His son had called me, this is confidential, his son called me in the meantime and said, if you let my father vote, you're crazy, because he hasn't had any capacity to think seriously about this question in the last several years, 2 or 3 years. But I thought...
This is the man with Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, well, it's better to let them vote, even though they're both negative votes. I knew they were both no votes. So we started out with 2 no's by telephone. Then we started around. And right on my left, there were 2 no's out of the first 3. I thought it was a dead deal. I really honestly did at that point. But counting the 2 in absentia votes, there were 7 negatives and 17 positives. So we just made it 2/3 standard. And I give Jim Ballingy a lot of credit for the way that whole business was managed, the study. I give our Edgar Shannon a lot of credit, the way he managed the Academic Affairs Committee as chairman, and a lot of the questions there, admission, student quality, course enrollment by sex, and things of that sort had to be thrashed out. We studied Princeton and Franklin and Marshall and other places to see if enrollments and economics stayed the same as a percentage, whether they changed, you know, things of that sort. He managed all that. Plus, of course, the University of Virginia admitted women to the undergraduate program in 1970, I think, and Edgar was president still at that time. So he was very helpful. There were a lot of helpful people around that table. But it was a heartfelt and deeply emotional meeting. And then we went over to the Commerce School for a press conference after we had voted aye and were going forward. And the chief opponent, in the sense of having the most strongly held views and also being as well prepared and thoughtful as he could possibly be on the subject, was Chris Compton, the Supreme Court Virginia Supreme Court Justice. And Chris came over and sat at the table with Jim Ballingy and with me as the press began to ask questions. And he said, I frankly acknowledge that I oppose this motion and I voted against it. But there will be no member of this board that will more ardently support it and will work to make it successful than will I. And that started the healing process.
The story gives me chills just hearing it.
Yeah. But you see that we didn't know also how many women there would be who would be interested in.
Well, what kind of response did you get?
Well, the first year, in 85, we had 750 or so applications from women. And they were strong. They were from Washington Lee people. We wanted 100 students. Well, 100 women students first year. And second year it went to 900 and some, third year it went to 1200 and some, the fourth year 1500 and some. I mean, the applications just kept coming. And they turned out to be from the same background, sometimes the same families, really, of our young men. And the first class was outstanding, the class of 89. They were superb the way they didn't come in and say, wait a minute, you know. They went along, they had a patience. They kind of turned their backs on the more outrageous no Marthas, you know, kind of attitude that some of the fraternities had. Some of the fraternities, for example, and they are functioning true to their nature when they reflect a kind of superficial, masculine, macho attitude about things, you know. And they also have a capacity to continue these attitudes from one generation to another. So it takes longer than 4 years to sort of change the system. It takes 7 to 8 years. So you can sort of start flushing out the memory of, well, the way it used to be. How do you know? Well, when I was a freshman, you know, my senior brother was the last non-co-ed class, and he told, you know, so she got but anyway, there were some fraternities who would not invite Washington Lee women to social nights, for example, for a while. It didn't last long, but and they would sort of aggressively announce that they were roadrunners, you know, they've been down the road for their social life, and women came welcome from Hollins and Sweetbriar and Mary Baldwin. And so. But our gals, they were so bright, so good-looking, so attractive, they blew that off without any problem, as they say.
I'm interested in this idea of that the first year you wanted 100, and there was a set number for each year that you were...
Well, the board said, John, what do you anticipate the enrollment pattern change?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really talk too much about this in the Academic Affairs Committee, but we did some. But anyway, I said, well, I don't know how many applications we're going to have, or I don't know what the quality of the applications will be, comparatively or absolutely. I do know that after 10 years, Princeton is still at 66% male applications, 35% female, and that Williams is 60-40, and somebody else is 57-43, after 10 or 12 years. So I said, I would think we'd be doing well if we got to 500 women. We had 1,350 men. I said, my proposal would be, let's reduce 1,350 to 1,000 and raise from 0 to 500 the number of women in 10 years' time. If we can do that, that would be a good achievement. And then we'll make our changes in dormitories and things in an evolutionary fashion.
And what were those changes? What had to be done to make way for, make ready for?
Very little, very little. I mean, it was amazing how little there was. Major physical renovation was in the gymnasium locker room. We had to partition, of course, down the middle, so we had equal number of lockers on each. Well, actually not equal, because there were more men than women anticipated. And that cost some money. But I got a check from a member of the class of 1915 called Will Smith. 1915. He was in his 90s, in other words. And he just sent a check. He didn't send a letter. On the memo line of the check, it said, to help with the girls. And it was $50,000 from Ardmore, Oklahoma. I went out to see Will Smith, obviously, and thank him and to come to know him a little bit. And he said, you know, I came to Virginia. My father, all of us here were in Oklahoma Territory. It wasn't even a state then. He bundled us on the train when our education time came, and we all went out east to Richmond. He said, I got off the train in Richmond with my brothers and sisters. We were in homemade clothes. There weren't any stores, and you know, but the father was in cattle, and he was in later in oil, and he was a successful man, but nonetheless, it was the condition of things. He said, I went to Randolph-Macon Academy up here at Front Royal for 3 or 4 years, and then I came to Washington Lee, and it was the best 4 years of my life, 1911 to 1915, he said, with one exception. He said, there was no opportunity to meet wholesome young women. I've never forgotten that phrase, wholesome young women. And so he said, I'm very pleased about that. Finally, after all these years, it's being corrected, and I hope you can use that $50,000. I used that to change the gym around. He was a jock, too. He was a little guy, but he was...
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, it is a great story.
I'll be real surprised if that doesn't make it into the book. That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, well, Will Smith didn't live much longer than that, but he did, have a chance to have an impact. Then the other things in the dormitories, we had to change restrooms from one sex to another, but that's a relatively simple thing to do, especially if you don't take the plumbing out, you know, you just cover them with vanities. You make urinals, which is a lie against the wall, of course, and you just build a plywood vanity over the top of it. They're still there.
In case you change the light.
And, the major thing was, in terms of change was programmatic and athletic. I mean, we had to start out and create, as it turned out, 9 or 10 varsity teams, you know, in a relatively short period of time. And these young women who arrived in the class of 89, there were only 100 of them, and they wanted a soccer team immediately. And the athletic people said, you can't do that. It takes 30, 35 people to make a squad so you can just play against each other and have a few substitutes. That would be a third of your class. They said, we'll get a third of our class. They must have dragooned these poor ladies, you know, young ladies who'd never seen a soccer ball to get out there. It was just remarkable how that whole success story on the athletic side has been just superb. You know, our tennis team and our soccer team.
Tell me about it.
Well, it's all there in the record. You can look at it. But the parity of esteem and the parity of in terms of success of our athletic teams, cross country, think of Josephine and all those gals. The tennis team is third in the nation last year. Swimming is outstanding. They get along well. They travel together. I give Paige Remillard a lot of credit for the way he's kept the men's and women's programs in parity. And Jan has been a wonderful addition. Jan Haythorne, with her both lacrosse and soccer teams, have had a lot of success. I mean, just I'm talking now not simply about wins and losses, but that's one measurement, but also the spirit and the morale and thing. And, you know, it's one thing about athletic teams that most people don't stop to think about, and that is that as a freshman class arrives, there's a need to socialize them into the community. That's what Greek system, you know, that's one of the rationalizations for Greek system, that you pledge and you get to know upperclassmen in a lot of number of houses when you're rushing or whatever you go. And then you join a house and you're immediately, well, after the nonsense, you're immediately part of a community of all four classes, plus alumni. You have sort of instant connection. Well, the athletic team works exactly the same way, but without all the nonsense, all the rush and hell week and whatever, all that stuff that BMI has not learned to do without, neither have the Greek system houses. But the athletic team admits that freshman into a community of people with shared interests, and they travel together, and they play together, and they turn out to be very close with each other. That's been a great help.
I'd like to turn to another subject that I know you were... Are we running out of time?
It's only 12. That's all right.
Do we need to stop?
No, not from my point of view.
I had the pleasure the other night of attending the Christmas concert at the Lenfest Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that happened during your administration,
yeah,
too. Tell me about the Lenfest Center. Why was that important, and how did it come to be?
Well, I believe very strongly in the efficacy of the arts and the efficacy measured in, let me start again. The question is, how do you develop powers of empathy? How do you cultivate the emotional side of human personality in constructive ways? How do you teach compassion? And I don't mean to make this sound as stilted as I'm sure it's beginning to sound, but when I was a young man, I would sit at home listening to because my mother was an opera person, Texaco opera on Saturday afternoons, you know, on the radio, or we had records, and music was very much a part of my, and sometimes you'd sit there and almost weep with the joy of it, you know, it's a powerful language. It's difficult to talk about because it can't communicate in quite the same way as verbal forms do, poetry or prose, but it's a little bit like, I mean, I've always thrilled, is the right word, to language. When I remember Manly Hopkins, you know, the first time I read his poetry, I remember as a child, I remember being kid. I remember actually physically feeling this emotion. Almost, the music does that too. I you know, I'm known locally in Lexington as a Mahler nut, and in fact, the board, one of the great gifts I got when I left, when I retired, was Anne and I were sent to Amsterdam to hear Mahler's Second Symphony, which was being played, because the second is especially moving, especially a wonderful piece of music, in my opinion. But anyway, I put that tape in the car when I'm by myself and turn the volume up and listen to that last movement, and I find myself weeping, driving down the road. Well, Washington and Lee was and this is true of a lot of all-male places, had a very modest... Rob Stewart was the first appointment in music. And I've talked about music here, but theater has a parallel place in the moral instruction of the young. And Rob Stewart was the first appointment in music. And we didn't have very much... Of course, since that time, Gordon Spice was on board, and there was a man called Cook who taught piano, and well, that was about it. And in theater, Al was there, of course, and I'm not sure how. I think Tom Ziegler was there, but at any rate, the music was performed in Lee Chapel, which acoustically is very nice. Every other way, awful. Especially for a large group. You can't get a group on that little platform. And the theater was done in the Troubadour, which some remarkable things were done there, but you know, could only exit the stage one side, you know, you couldn't go down. And it seated 100 if you were lucky, and it had a stage the size of a thimble, and there weren't any. How they did as well as they did, I'll never know. But at any rate, in the 70s, Frank can tell you about this, there was a strong feeling that the arts had to be regenerated and that a physical environment had to be created for them. And Bob Huntley actually had it on his list of things that should be done in that 70s campaign, which turned out to be a $67 million campaign. But they never got to it. So I inherited what, in fact, turned easily to be something that I was totally enthusiastic about anyway, the obligation to provide a suitable place for the arts at Washington Lee. And we had on the planning board, as it were, a 300-seat theater for drama, nothing for music. And that was one of the difficult negotiating points with Al. I wanted the auditorium larger for musical events. And there was a good argument advanced that you'd spoil a theater if you try to make it multi-purpose. And that they didn't want more than 300 seats because they wanted a play to run for several nights and we would exhaust an audience.
In Lexington.
485 seats. So anyway, to make a long story short, we had to negotiate all that. And I said, in effect, to myself and to Al, I guess, and to Rob Stewart and Gordon, that we would only have one chance to do this. We wouldn't have a chance to do two theaters.
Good point.
Not in foreseeable future anyway, so they could work out a way to share these spaces, the experimental theater and the large auditorium. And so we started out really before the campaign to raise the money for this, and we asked some key people to contribute to it, and I remember sitting with Chris and Polly Keller down in Louisiana, and they gave 800,000, for example. And then the wonderful story about Jerry himself coming up for his 53 reunion.
Let's switch the tape to get that.
All right.